This recording is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at cvillepodcast.com. On Thursday, October 16, 2008, local author Wynn Collier presented his new book, Holy Curiosity, to an audience at the New Dominion Bookshop in Charlottesville. Collier investigates the questions that Jesus asks in the Gospel, ranging from, "Why are you afraid?" to, "Are you being willfully stupid?" After his presentation, Collier took questions from the audience.
Well, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. I'm definitely new to town, so it's great just to have some people show up. That's really great. I appreciate it. This is my third book, but I actually started it long before I wrote my second book. And so this one has been a long time in the making through a couple different publishers and a couple restarts and just some dry periods, but it's really cool tonight. I can't believe it, like after 4 years, to let it fly. And so, it is cool. For me, writing is an art. I hope that the writing, I don't always accomplish this, but I hope for it to be not just thoughtful, but also beautiful. And so, obviously, you'll have to decide that, but that's my hope and desire. And really, this emerged for me in large part because I'm a questioner. It seems like I most often in my life have had way more questions than I had answers, and that certainly continues now. And I was both sort of intrigued and disturbed, found just very interesting how that Jesus so many times in the gospel readings would pose a question to someone. And I think that's interesting for multiple reasons, some just because of how relational it is. Jesus was very curious about people and their heart and their story and their life. And I think we live in a world where we're not curious about each other nearly enough. And so I found that really interesting. I also found it interesting because the Christian tradition that I grew up in would have presented to me a picture of Jesus as someone who always had the answer, as someone who was always ready to didactically correct someone. And I found in my reading of the Gospels a Jesus who oftentimes had another way of interacting. And even for some of us, it raises interesting questions. How can Jesus be, you know, the Son of God and also not know everything? Which is a great question that I think is worthy of a whole other book. So what I did with this book was I just mused around a few questions that I found in the Gospels. I did a list of all of them, and then picked out 9 of them that seemed like they best connected with where my story is right now, and so that's sort of how they were chosen. And so I'm going to read a portion from chapter 3, which is called "Why Are You Afraid?" In the deep south where I live, we have an annual summer pariah. Kudzu looks something like ivy, but spreads so fast you measure its progress by the hour. I've seen kudzu take over 20-foot utility light poles, carpet an entire hillside, and most astonishingly devour an abandoned car parked too close to the woods. Kudzu works steadily, consistently. You really don't notice what is happening, a sprout here, an intruding vine there, but all of a sudden you look out at your front yard and it's gone, gobbled up, kudzu everywhere. Fear is the heart's kudzu. It works fast, and it aims to consume us. Fear, says novelist Jan Martel, has no decency, respects no law or convention, shows no mercy. The gospel writer Matthew tells a story of a murky, tempestuous night when fear consumed Jesus' disciples. The disciples and Jesus were on a fishing boat late in the evening. Jesus was asleep. Without warning, a fierce storm hit the Sea of Galilee. Matthew called it a furious storm. A seismos, as the Greeks put it. Usually, the word seismos referred to an earthquake and often implied an apocalyptic cataclysm. This was not just wind and bluster. A vicious torrent descended on this small band of men trapped in the middle of an angry sea, and they were terrified. Several of these men were fishermen. They had seen their share of storms and had been through more than a few strong gales. I don't know when you last spent time in a fishing village, but the men and women who run those boats are anything but timid. They're salty folk. This storm, however, was a different beast, and the disciples weren't going to be able to ride it out as they had before. Life has a way of pushing right past the boundaries we construct. Tragedy and heartache don't play by the rules. We might maneuver long enough so we can begin to believe that we possess the courage to navigate whatever we will meet, but then a seismos comes. A late-night call from the police, a bankruptcy, a child with an incurable disease, an AIDS crisis, famine, poverty, and we are terrified. Terrified, the disciples rush to Jesus, stunned to find him asleep in the middle of the mayhem. Awaking to the brutal storm and the terror-stricken faces, Jesus asked a question that seems absurd. Why are you afraid? Well, there was the crashing wind whipping the boat like a toothpick in a hurricane. There was the monsoon-like waves roaring so loudly the men could barely hear themselves scream. There was the fact that every instinct told them they would never see land again, yet Jesus asked them why exactly it was they were afraid. Fear has many common instigators: hairy spiders, disorienting heights, public speaking, enclosed spaces. Fear also comes from the rawest wounds of our soul. The father who never showed us how valuable we were, the years of being the outsider at school, the boss who said we were useless, the sin that left long scars. From these places and because of these voices, we live afraid, running away and trying to prove or protect ourselves. When I was younger and my choices less significant, fear was a less noticeable problem. But as I grew older and my decisions and the consequences of those decisions grew larger, choosing a career, deciding to have kids, fear found much more material to work with. With each new decision, the stakes are raised. As essayist Timothy Stanley says, fear is part of us. It is the basic experience of facing unknown limits. But we shudder at the unknown. And we strive to find comfort by managing our life, minimizing risk, and keeping a steady equilibrium. We want our marriage to work and our kids to stay healthy and our hopes to never be dashed too harshly. So we figure out what works and we do it, an infinite quest to maintain a steady hand at the wheel. Of the many words I could use to describe Branson, Missouri, dangerous is not one of them. Tucked away in a quiet corner of the Ozarks, Branson was once a small mountain town that has become a Mecca-like destination for people, mostly older, who love hillbilly music and outlet malls and pecan pralines and who possess abiding affection for Dolly Parton. Still, reputation aside, I was once terrified in Branson. When I was in college, our family headed to Branson one summer for vacation. My sister, Vonda, 4 years younger than me, has a bit of a wild streak, and as soon as we rolled into town, she spotted the Sky Coaster, a bare, still tower looming 100 feet off the ground. The Sky Coaster is built for people with borderline personality disorders who find perverse pleasure in having their stomachs slammed into their throats as they free fall like a brick screeching toward the pavement. Of course, as soon as Vonda spotted the Sky Coaster, she wanted in on the action, and she wanted me to join her. Have I mentioned that I'm afraid of heights? I was the kid who stood frozen atop the pool's high dive board, the kid whose mom, who incidentally can't even swim, had to climb up to initiate a rescue, only my mom's rescue was to give me a shove off the board. But that's another story. I'm the guy who can't look down at the narrow slits between the boards of a suspended walkway. Nonetheless, because no self-respecting college guy can tell his little sister, "No, I will not ride the Sky Coaster because I'm scared I might wet my pants," I found myself in line holding a ticket and standing next to one very psyched-up sibling. The Sky Coaster attendant shoved us both into an enormous harness. Imagine what a diaper for an elephant would look like. And then hooked us to a taut steel wire stretched to the top of the tower. One of the guys placed my hand on a red plastic handle and told me that when we reached the top to count to three and pull. Gravity would take care of the rest. Pull, that's it. We reached the top far too quickly. By that point, there were few options. We could stay there, staring at the asphalt far below, suspended in midair inside a large body diaper, or I could pull. But as soon as I pulled that cord, everything was out of my hands, everything. The red handle offered only a small illusion of my ability to maintain control over my situation, but that illusion was all that I had. I clutched that handle as though it were life itself until eventually I had to pull the cord. It seems to me the fear of being caught when I don't have a firm grasp on the situation prompts most all my fears. When I asked Miska to marry me, she responded by asking me, unfortunately, repeatedly, if I was sure about my decision. Sure. That's a tricky word for me, and immediately vicious fears of the unknown dug in. Recently, I watched a documentary called The Darfur Diaries. It chronicles the tragedy and genocide in Darfur, a western region of Sudan. The violence is sickening. Genocide and bombs and rape and hunger and thousands of children who have lived horrors no human should ever know. Isn't there a part of us that would just rather not see these images or hear these stories? These faces and these cruelties are something we cannot manage. The unnerving truth is that it isn't just the chaos in other places that we cannot manage. We're often helpless against the chaos present in the middle of our own immediate world. Fear is what happens when we finally come face to face with the brutality of life. We recognize that we are far too small to stop it from doing as it pleases. When this happens, we can lean into the fear, curious as to what we might uncover about ourselves, or we can exert vast amounts of energy trying to beat back the internal bedlam. Most reads on this storm narrative hear Jesus' question, "Why did they fear?" as an unqualified reprimand. There's something to this, particularly since Jesus pointedly asked them where their faith had gone. However, Scripture says that Jesus' rebuke was leveled at the raging wind and the waves, not the disciples. I don't hear Jesus' words to the 12 as an irritated scold. It seems that Jesus calls his disciples out, calling them to see their fears for what they are, calling them to courage. A fear that is ignored and constantly shoved to the edges is not defeated. It is merely given time to sharpen its fangs. Such fears must be invited to the light, and in this case, an invasive question was Jesus' invitation. His question was not an exasperated reaction to the disciples' fear. The truth is that God's sovereign control was not at all obvious. My hunch is that anyone who would chastise the disciples for having fear in this moment has simply not lived honestly enough, has simply not allowed the devastation of this world to come in close. There is little mystery to the fact that the disciples were fearful in the middle of dark, raging, frothing waters that were ready to take them under. I understand why they were afraid. I am far more curious about why Jesus wasn't. One could quickly dismiss the whole query by asserting that Jesus is God and God doesn't get scared. Maybe. But was there no fear in Gethsemane when Jesus sweated blood and asked God to save him from the darkness to come? Was there no fear on the cross when Jesus cried out to the Father who had abandoned him? How can Jesus be one who, as Hebrews tells us, has been through weakness and testing, experienced it all, if he has not felt the sadistic power of fear? Is it possible that Jesus' correction of the disciples was not so much for feeling fear as it was for obeying it? After Jesus woke to the barbarous conditions and his unnerved disciples, he stepped to the ship's edge and spoke words to the wind. He simply told the wind to stop. And it did. The disciples didn't know what to do with what they had just seen. What kind of man is this? They asked. Even the wind and the waves obey him. Authority. It calms a storm and is the only remedy for a fearful soul. Techniques are not what we really need. A pep talk to muster our resolve is not the answer. That is the stuff of self-help. Continuing the delusion that our only requisite is just a more courageous version of ourselves. However, our real need is one who is far larger than us, one who will show us that we are not alone and that our fears are not the most powerful truth. We need a God large enough and strong enough to be in control of our precarious life. In Finding Neverland, the wonderful cinematic portrayal of the friendship J.M. Barrie, who was Peter Pan's creator, fostered with four fatherless boys, a poignant scene develops near the end. One of the younger boys, Peter, who was the namesake for Peter Pan, had taken his father's death and his mother's subsequent terminal illness the hardest. At his mother's funeral, he ran away into the park so he could hide his emotions and attempt to cope. He resisted any person's claim to his trust, believing that his safety rested fully on his own shoulders. For Peter, his mother's death confirmed his darkest dread. He was in charge of his well-being. As Barrie approached Peter, sitting alone on a remote park bench, Peter struggled to push his short legs to the ground so he could launch from the bench and run further away. But Barrie's voice, firm and direct, halted his efforts. "Peter, sit down," he said. The words were short, straightforward, yet there was something in Barrie's eyes, something in his heart, something in the way he was stepping into Peter's chaos that was life-giving. Barry Stantz told Peter he was not alone. He was not in charge of his own safety. Barry was stronger than Peter, and Barry was there to help. But first, Peter would need to sit down. This is a simple scene, a man telling a boy to take his seat on a bench, but it is much more. The boy was lost, alone. He needed someone bigger, someone with enough courage to step into his chaos. He needed someone strong enough to handle him and wise enough to know how and when to use his strength. So many times I've been on that bench, a little boy wondering if there is anyone bigger than me, big enough to tell me I am not on my own. We've all sat there, and our heart yearns for another who is stronger and wiser, to speak with authority, to speak words of hope and life. Make no mistake, the disciples were in trouble. They had every reason to fear. But the disciples had missed that Emmanuel, God, was sleeping in the hole. God was with them, and God was at rest. The same is true for us. It would be a lie to say there is nothing to fear. The truth, however, is that Jesus has stepped between us and our fears. He takes fear's fury. We must ask ourselves if we believe that God is with us in Jesus. We must ask ourselves if we believe Jesus truly has the authority to meet our fears head on and to speak against them, each and every one. It is true, as Aquinas taught us, that when God is with us, there is much that simply ought not to be feared. Whenever Wyatt, our oldest son, calls me upstairs to his room at night and tells me he's afraid, it does little good to tell him bluntly there's nothing to be afraid of. It's true, there are no hairy green monsters in the darkened corner, no malevolent shadows waiting to pounce. However, his fears come from deeper places. Wyatt fears he will be alone. Wyatt fears he will be left to himself to fend off the menace his imagination conjures up for him. Wyatt needs to know his dad and his mom are nearby. Wyatt wants to know that, as he likes to say it, if I really need something, you'll come up. So even as I tell Wyatt that there are no monsters, I want to be quicker to tell him what he most needs to hear, that his safety is not in his own hands. That if any scary creatures are foolish enough to enter my son's room, his dad will be there, hell on wheels, faster than he can blink to dish up a grade-A monster butt-whooping. So in this instance, what Wyatt really needs are not tools to rationalize his fears away, but rather to come face-to-face with his father's strength. And this is a conversation every dad was made for. Wyatt, I say, you bet, buddy. If you need me, I'll be up here faster than lightning. And in Wyatt's world, nothing is faster than lightning. As Wyatt shows the first hints of a grin, I continue, and you know what else? When I get up here, I'll crush every monster there is. Wyatt's beaming now, quite excited, actually. He likes the sound of this crushing stuff. Do you know why you don't need to be afraid, I ask? No, he answers, sitting up on his knees in his bed, wide-eyed and now half-hoping a monster or two would saunter in. Because, I say, your daddy is stronger than any monster there is. Then I put Wyatt back under his covers so he can drift to sleep, dreaming about all the cool stuff his dad would do if he ever snagged one of those monsters in a headlock. Wyatt's fears are best tamed, not by an argument or a psychological technique, but by his dad's hand, his dad's voice, his dad's authority. Simply dousing fears really isn't the solution. Being present, that is the stuff of hope. Incarnation is the place, says Kathleen Norris, where hope contends with fear. Perhaps this hints at the reason, if Jesus was familiar with fear, he was not distraught in the boat that was battered by the ferocious storm. He was not afraid because he was aware of God the Father with him. Perhaps this also tells us why the cross evoked such a different, disquieted response from Jesus. There, as the sky turned black and as Jesus cried out as only a forsaken man could, God was nowhere to be found. That is a place of terror. Christ has known ultimate fear. He has known fear in ways we never will. It is not that Jesus is unable to understand the range of our fears, it is that we are unable to understand the depth of his. We must resist any easy notion that Jesus never knew fear. This does injustice to his humanity, and it offers little hope when fear engulfs us. How can we say God is truly with us if he has not been at times immersed, like us, in a torrent of fear? This God incarnated, this blood and bone God in Jesus, came to contend with fear. He did not come only to face nobly fear's blunt force and die. Jesus' face-off with fear did not conclude on a darkened Friday when hope was lost and hell quivered with pleasure. After cross came resurrection, and in the mysterious hours between the two, Jesus took death and sin, all that makes up the foul side of fear, and placed them squarely under his crushing heel. Fear unleashed all it possessed on Jesus, a torrent of death and shame and abandonment and sin, enough to finish even the strongest of men. But fear did not destroy Jesus. Jesus destroyed fear. Our comfort and courage do not come from a Jesus who was unmolested by fear. Our comfort comes from a Jesus who went into fear's very bowels for us. He drank in every acidic ounce of fright and distress and vexation. For us, he drank it in. And now, as he stands leaning toward us, Emmanuel asks kindly, "Why are you afraid?" That's it. Thank you. Now it's... If anyone has questions, right? One, just because of the, is when Jesus asks, "Are you being willfully stupid?" Just because it doesn't sound like the kind of thing Jesus would say. Do you believe this? For me, probably, because I've struggled so much with doubt, doubt in my faith, that wrestling with Jesus' pretty straightforward question at times is, "Do you believe what I say?" Because our reason and will only take us so far, and there comes a point, I think, where we have to decide whose word we will trust. And I like to trust my own word, and that only gets me so far. But I think my favorite one was the last question was, "What do you want?" I think asking ourselves what our deepest desires are is one of the most unnerving, hopeful, beautiful things we can ask ourselves. And to be forced to sort of wrestle with that in Jesus' words was probably the one I enjoyed the most. So I think it's probably the most important. The publisher told me that that's what they wanted to title it. Yeah. You know, typically when you sell the rights to a book, the publishing house has the final say about the cover art and the title because that's a marketing issue, and they want to protect their investment. It was originally, the working title was just Questions Jesus Asks, which is simple. I like simple, but I didn't like it because it sounded like one of those, you know, 10 things to do for this and that kind of thing, like a self-help kind of book. I could see it being sold at Walmart on one of the end carts, you know. So we wrangled around it for a while, and we just came to it together. So, and I liked it.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I mean, yes, absolutely. Dialogue with lots of theologians, lots of thinkers, lots of writers, lots of a poet into, you know. Right. Yeah. I try to. In fact, a couple places where I found myself going with the questions made me want to delve into some theological work a little bit more, just because I wanted to make sure I wasn't being heretical, at least from an Orthodox Christian perspective, because I hadn't some of the things I hadn't really heard anyone say quite like this before, and that always makes me nervous.